At work, I took hour-long naps in the supply closet under the stairs during my lunch breaks. Napping is such a childish word, but that was what I was doing.
This intriguing phrase is taken from Ottessa Moshfegh's 2018 novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, our novel of choice for debating the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, which have come to be known as 9/11. To me, it's unbelievable that this should be 20 years ago. In the same time, I feel that 9/11 marks a threshold in politics and in artistic production and aesthetic responses to the present moment. So I have many questions about this, and I'm super excited to explore a piece of lady fiction that revisits the period just before September 11. And I'm grateful to my colleague, Dr. Marius Henderson, for suggesting the novel to me and for agreeing to be my guest today. Hi, Marius.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a huge honor and pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming. So before we dive into the novel right away, I'd like to have a few words of introduction so our listeners will know a little bit more about Marius. Marius is an Americanist and researcher from the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany. He studied English and American studies and gender studies at Hamburg and at Johns Hopkins University. And in his 2019 dissertation deals with modes of rendering suffering in contemporary experimental North American poetry. He's a member of Erlangen's Global Sentimentality Project, and his research interests include affect theory, abstraction and objection, and this is also the focus of his current research project, African-American studies, gender and queer studies, modernist and avant-garde studies, and artistic research. Marius regularly cooperates with other scholars, writers, and artists, and is interested in collaboratively exploring and bridging gaps between scholarly and artistic practices. And that, I think, is a great starting point for latching onto the representation of the New York City art industry, which we have in Moshfegh's Year of Rest and Relaxation. But I would like to postpone that a little bit and like to start by opening and looking at the novel a bit more generally through the lens of 9/11 literature. So let's maybe introduce our readers to the novel. What's it all about?
The novel is narrated by an unnamed narrator who's also the protagonist of the novel. However, she is quite open also about certain markers of identity. She's a cis female character who also identifies as a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant with blonde hair who matches contemporary normative beauty standards. She's just fresh out of college, a Columbia University graduate, majoring in art history. And as the novel sets in, she works for a gallery in Chelsea.
Which all sounds like it's the perfect life you want to live, right?
It definitely does, and I guess we'll come back to that, to different forms of life and possibilities and impossibilities of maybe breaking out of certain subject positions. But as the title already says, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, the novel mainly follows the experiment of the narrator slash protagonist who tries to sleep as much as possible for an entire year, which is the year ranging from 2000 until 2001. So we can already bear that in mind. It ends in 2001, thinking of the 9/11 attacks. So she basically tries to cop out from a state of being awake and tries to sleep as much as she can. And in doing so, she does so by taking all kinds of medication, prescription pills of various sorts, And she also has a, well, resourceful companion in that, a psychotherapist or psychiatrist called Dr. Tuttle, with whom she is in therapy and who makes sure that she's never lacking new supplies of sleep-inducing medication. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a body experiment that she goes through. And when I started reading, I was like, okay, that's interesting. And then halfway through the novel, I thought, okay, it's really weird. So I became increasingly estranged with her determination to put this through, this experiment. Sleep as much as you can and do as little as you possibly can. So she really also has a regime when she works up. When she wakes up, she has a piece of pizza. She does some crunches to keep her muscles from totally going away. And then she takes the next medication and she goes to sleep again. And the novel is also a record of medical experimentation, because we have different medications and different outcomes of those medications that we have to discuss in between. If it wasn't for the experiment only and the end point, this could be something I think that could be said at any time. But when she decides that the experiment is over, that's the day of September 11th. So that's her first day when she says, okay, the experiment is done. I did my sleep. And that's the end point of this, which makes this novel, published in 2018, a novel about the time leading up to the 9/11 attacks. Of course, in retrospect. So I don't think you can read the novel without thinking about the threshold or the game changer or the epoch marking events that seem to be 9/11 to us today. So first of all, I think we have to discuss how much is this of a 9/11 novel and how does it deal with it? When I looked back from a contemporary standpoint, I was struck by all the end formulations. So we have the end of history, the quote by Francis Fukuyama, which has been, which he himself has been revoked in the meantime. So, but this was supposedly the end of history. From an artistic or aesthetic standpoint, it's been called the end of irony, end of postmodernist language play. So the end of the linguistic turn, so to speak, and a crisis of signification that led to endless language games and a reduction or a turn to language only because representation as such had become impossible. And then the big question is, what comes after that? When I was writing my dissertation in the early 2000s, I was also looking at contemporary literature, and I remember turning away from 9/11 literature and from the terminology involved in this, because I thought it was too early, and I was too insecure about calling the text that I was reading 9/11 literature or post 9/11 literature. But in the meantime, of course, there were lots of literary scholars who have commented on this. And when I looked back, I found that 10 years after, in 2011, there's a conference at the University of Bonn that has been published in an essay collection, Beyond 9/11, where Simone Knewitz, Christian Klöckner, and Sabine Sielke reflect on how 9/11 not so much was a marker, but how it has shifted our focus and, quote, made us think differently about historical, political, social, and cultural processes. So while 10 years after, it was still critical to say, was this the very moment, or was there more a period maybe of rest and relaxation or something that led up to this moment that made this shift of focus happen to us? 10 years after, they felt compelled to say, it made us think differently and we want to reflect on this. And in the present moment, it's more like a reflection of the lack of terminology. And so this month and this time of year, of course, in 2021, we will see lots of commentaries, people coming out saying it was this, it was that. We marked 20 years. So much has changed ever since. What would be your take on reading this as a 9/11 novel?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm I'm familiar with some of those discourses, of course, meaning so-called, quote-unquote, 9/11 literature, as well as with critical and theoretical discourses. Having been in high school during the 9/11 attacks, this is a part of kind of also kind of active remembrance on my part of having lived through that period of time as well. And what I found quite convincing also that when a review or that this discussion opinion piece on Mosfeig's novel by Ariel Sarimandi that was published on Electric Literature was that he in a way makes the argument that Mosfeig's novel also really, at least throughout most of its passages in this phase leading up to the 9/11 attacks, in a way is also a revisiting in a way of the quote unquote long 1990s as a kind of intermediate phase between the Cold War mm-hmm. and then the 9/11 attacks and the so-called quote unquote war on terror, to a certain degree maybe raising the question in how far this supposed intermediate phase which was or at least as it is to a certain degree depicted in the novel as a phase of certain level of carelessness and optimism, maybe even not necessarily by the protagonist, but by the social circles and the milieu that she's a part of, meaning educated, mainly or predominantly white cultural elites, so to speak, or supposed self-proclaimed elites, artistic elites, and so on and so forth in New York, and how this latent optimism in a way resonates with the phase following after the Bush years, the Bush Jr. years, meaning during the Obama presidency, if one wants to kind of use these presidencies as possible markers, and then leading up to the Trump presidency as a renewed moment of crisis. But at least that as a certain form of structure of feeling which the text maybe conveys. However, it's important that this notion of carelessness and optimism once more is very much seems to be tied in with the situatedness of certain subjectivities. But coming back to the question of 9/11 literature, I would definitely say that you noticed that this novel came out 10 years after, or a decade after these somewhat by now maybe even canonized 9/11 novels came out, and to a certain degree also presents new takes on the issue. I mean, I'm thinking of novels such as Don DeLillo's Falling Man or Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. On the one hand, I mean, I guess we can speak about new sincerity as
yeah,
well, but
that was one of the yeah.
I mean, in the novels that I just mentioned, they've been very much also discussed along the lines of trauma theory and discussed kind of 9/11 as a traumatic event for individuals and as reflected in individual characters, but also as a kind of collective trauma. And I would say that Mosfeig's novel moves away from the trauma narrative to a certain degree, even though issues of mental health, mental distress, and trauma also play a huge part. But given, I mean, the basic setting and this experiment of trying to numb oneself to recede from the waking life as much as possible kind of presents a more detached position, maybe in relation to also issues of traumatization. Yeah.
We have to talk trauma a little bit and its meanings in the novel. So it's called My Year of Rest and Relaxation, but of course we never find out why she takes this decision to sleep as much as she can. It's only in between the lines. So the reading experience is one that, you know, I as a reader, I was constantly questioning what happened before. And then who is she? So it's a little bit of a medias res, jumping in situation, where we start with the experiment right away. We learn in between that she lost both of her parents at a very short, interim. There's also talk about how they passed. So her father was a professor who was sick, and her mom basically killed herself. So there is a trauma perspective there in which she cannot deal with that loss. She's overwhelmed with it, but at the same time, she continues her life. She has an inheritance. She's very comfortable because of her parents' death. She can do this experiment in New York City in her apartment. So I'm going to take the book here and go to the pages that I marked. So we are constantly looking for, I was constantly looking for reasons why she was doing this. And she basically says, I felt nothing. I could think of feelings, emotions, but I couldn't bring them up in me. I couldn't even locate where my emotions came from. So she's always wondering what's going on. Why doesn't she feel anything? Was sadness the same kind of thing? Was joy, was longing, was love a physiological response? And in between, there's another quote that I'm going to talk about. She imagines becoming an ice queen. We have to talk about the ice references here. Let me be a cold bitch. Let me be the ice queen. You don't feel a thing. And then towards the end, and that's the question, you know, this is not a spoiler per se, but after the sleep, the outcome of the experiment, one of the outcomes is, and this is a quote again, I was soft and calm and felt things. This was good. So she has lost the sense of feeling. She doesn't know how to feel. And then in the end, after sleeping so much, she diagnoses herself with feeling something again. So the loss of emotion and of authenticity of feeling is what triggers this. But there's also a lack of words that reminded me very much of trauma theory. You know, that which you can't speak about, which you can't put into words. So the trauma does work as a frame of reference for the novel.
I would definitely agree, and I mean that's one of the possible interpretations that the novel also offers. Her biographical experiences, the death, of course, frankly, quite traumatizing death of her parents, for instance. But I feel that at the same time, this is only one possible interpretation that is being offered, and due to the narrator's very often ironic or mm-hmm. sarcastic mm-hmm. Tone, that made it a bit more questionable for me, at least, to read it solely through this one lens, or to kind of in a way individualize and primarily psychologize this decision to sleep as much as possible. I mean, it's definitely, I would say, one of the frameworks that the text offers, but it's...
But what other reason does anyone have to decide to sleep for a year when you're like in your 20s and you live in New York City and you work in an art gallery? I mean, it's like, it looks like a very normative, desirable identity or this story of life, and then she decides to just go away. So trauma is one frame, but what did you think? Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Yeah, I guess this is also an intermingling of form and content. In that respect, I would say that this experiment very much, of course, verges on the surreal to a certain degree, or maybe even the fantastic, and some of the, I mean, the novel also contains long passages where the narrator lists all of the medication that she's taking, which is also reminiscent of certain novelistic traditions, also adds a certain degree of verisimilitude maybe to the text. At the same time, some of those medications are also invented. Also, this one medication that she takes.
A German invention. So I remember that. Yes, we have to check. What's it called? That medication gives her the greatest trips ever, right? That's the medication that dissolves the boundaries between sleep and waking, where she wakes up and she doesn't know. She collects her Polaroids from the things that she went on sleepwalking.
Infirmiteral, if one pronounce it or would pronounce it like that. Yes, and I feel that it's, in addition to those formal and maybe also thematic or conceptual investments in realism or neo-realism, there's this bridging on the surreal sometimes and maybe also tinges of romanticism and also a certain romanticist desire perhaps to evade and escape from the dynamics of, well, to put it plainly, a late capitalism or neoliberalism by opting out, by being as seemingly unproductive as possible, and without necessarily, as you already mentioned, I mean, giving her privileged position, without necessarily having a relatable reason, at least at a first sight. So maybe one could argue that this is a possible critique or critical reflection, reflecting on possibilities of refusal within a certain totalizing structural dynamics that the novel puts forth or also experiments with.
So let's take a moment with this refusal moment. So you also suggested that one of the possible, it's a 9/11 novel, but it's also a 2008 post economic crisis novel, in that she really opts out. She has the luxury. She can do this. She arranges for it. She doesn't have to work for a living. That's the starting point. But she does opt out of any role expectations, any norms that her personality at this age might be faced with. And there's an economic perspective, a refusal perspective in that, and that I find very appealing in your argument. So how do you read this as a 2008 novel?
Well, I saw certain resonances between her decision to opt out, to refusing to be quote unquote productive, however one wants to define that, to invest in self-optimization, all those imperatives which circulate. And so I also saw certain resonances with some of the social movements, socio-political movements that emerged in response to the 2008 crisis, such as the Occupy movement, or which began also in, I believe, in New York, in Zuccotti Park, as Occupy by Wall Street.
Yeah, I was thinking of him. He is the impersonation of that evil class of people. Yeah. So he comes, Trevor is his name. He's older, and he's on and off boyfriend, but it's a very, the relationship is based on sex. The kind of gratification she gets rests on the fact that she has to comply to whatever he wants most of the time. So it's not as if it's super fulfilling, or he's also not the love of her life in any way. He really much is not invested in her in the sense of the word. So whenever she's only a rebound for him, whenever he feels bad, he will come around. It's also funny. They're funny sex scenes, explicit funny sex scenes in the novel that we can't spoil here. But I laughed out loud in some situations because they're so grotesque. And this guy is really, really a caricature. But it's also very sad that he's he seems very realistic at the same time. So Occupy would be one approach to opting out, to trying to expose the workings of a neoliberal order that pervades every sense of being, and that dictates how persons can be in this book. So she also does a lot of napping. Maybe that's a nice cue. She has a job at the beginning of the novel, but she naps so much on the job and she gets so many things wrong that she's ultimately fired, which is what she was hoping for. So at the opening of this podcast, you quoted a phrase from the workplace. Maybe we can go to this section and read it, so the listeners also get a sense of this style of narration, which is monological and retrospective, but at the same time also leave so many questions open to the reader.
So this is where she's still at work and she naps in the supply closet, which is very funny.
And she works at the art gallery.
At work, I took hour-long naps in the supply closet under the stairs during my lunch breaks. Napping is such a childish word, but that was what I was doing. The tonality of my night's sleep was more variable, generally unpredictable, but every time I lay down in that supply closet, I went straight into black emptiness, an infinite space of nothingness. I was neither scared nor elated in that space. I had no visions. I had no ideas. If I had a distinct thought, I would hear it, and the sound of it would echo and echo until it got absorbed by the darkness and disappeared. There was no response necessary, no inane conversation with myself. It was peaceful. A vent in the closet released a steady flow of fresh air that picked up the scent of laundry from the hotel next door. There was no work to do, nothing I had to counteract or compensate for, because there was nothing at all, period. And yet I was aware of the nothingness. I was awake in the sleep somehow. I felt good, almost happy. But coming out of that sleep was excruciating. My entire life flashed before my eyes in the worst way possible, my mind refilling itself with all my lame memories, every little thing that had brought me to where I was. I tried to remember something else, a better version, a happy story maybe, or just an equally lame but different life that would at least be refreshing in its digressions. But it never worked. I was always still me. Sometimes I woke up with my face wet with tears. The only times I cried, in fact, were when I was pulled out of that nothingness, when the alarm on my cell phone went off. Then I had to trudge up the stairs, get coffee from the little kitchen, and rub the boogers out of my eyes. It always took me a while to readjust to the harsh fluorescent lighting. For a year or so, everything seemed fine with Natasha, that's her boss at the gallery. The most grief she gave me was about ordering the wrong pens. Why do we have all these cheap clickety pens? They're so loud when you click them. You can't hear this? She stood there, clicking at me. Sorry, Natasha, I said. I'll order quieter pens. Has FedEx come yet? I would rarely know how to answer that. Once I'd started seeing Dr. Tuttle, I was getting in 14, 15 hours of sleep a night during the work week, plus that extra hour at lunchtime. Weekends, I was only awake for a few hours a day. And when I was awake, I wasn't fully so, but in a kind of a murk, a dim state between the real and the dream. I got sloppy and lazy at work, grayer, emptier, less there. This pleased me, but having to do things became very problematic. When people spoke, I had to repeat what they'd said in my mind before understanding it. I told Dr. Tuttle I was having trouble concentrating. She said it was probably due to brain mist. Are you sleeping enough? Dr. Tuttle asked every week I went to see her. Just barely, I always answered. Those pills hardly put a dent in my anxiety. Eat a can of chickpeas, she said, otherwise known as garbanzos. And try these. She scribbled on her prescription pad. The array of medicines I was accumulating was awe-inspiring. Dr. Tuttle explained that there was a way to maximize insurance coverage by prescribing drugs for their side effects, rather than going directly to those whose main purposes were to relieve my symptoms, which were, in my case, debilitating fatigue due to emotional weakness, plus insomnia, resulting in soft psychosis and belligerence. That's what she told me she was going to write in her notes. She termed her prescribing method eco-scripting and said she was writing a paper on it that would be published soon in a journal in Hamburg. So she gave me pills that targeted migraine headaches, prevented seizures, cured restless leg syndrome, prevented hearing loss. These medicines were supposed to relax me so that I could get some much needed rest.
And the irony of this passage is, of course, that she tricks her doctor into giving her sleep pills when she only wants to sleep as much as she can. So she says that she has insomnia, but at the end of the day, she gets a prescription for more sleep so she can go on her experiment. Okay, so this passage is intriguing because, okay, we start out with the napping in the supply closet and the description of this kind of sleep, which I find intriguing, a nothingness. That is a key motif And opposite this is the excruciating experience of waking up again and being only me and having this boring life that she dreams about having something else. So what's the sleep description? It's actually a description of a different state of being that is beyond the here now.
Yeah. There's maybe two more things that I might add also to what I said previously, or to connect this passage with also the context of the post-2008 financial crisis context, the Occupy movement, and general observations with respect to the narration also, which is that during the initial Occupy Wall Street protests, there were marathon readings of Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, A Story of Wall Street, this short story being held at the protest site. And Bartleby, who's a scrivener, in, as the title announces, in a lawyer's office at Wall Street, at some point this character Bartleby, the story is narrated by the lawyer. At some point, Bartleby, who's initially a very reliable employee, however, he hasn't been employed for that long yet, at some point he refuses to respond to any of the tasks and the requests by his employer, and simply or answers with the famous phrase, "I would prefer not to," when he's asked to fulfill certain tasks, and in the end ends up being institutionalized imprisoned due to
the refusal, right? Due to him saying no most of the time, yeah?
This act of refusal and just this phrase, "I would prefer not to," which seemingly comes out of nowhere without a particular reason, in that case, for instance, a biographical, psychological reason or so, therefore became a kind of catchphrase, or Bartleby became a kind of poster child of Occupy, which also started as a broad movement which didn't necessarily emerge out of more classical political contexts or institutions such as parties or labor unions and so on and so forth, but it combined a multiplicity of activists which responded to this financial crisis without formulating clear demands, but simply in a way refused the status quo, mm-hmm. so to speak, in the system which had led to massive unemployment and precarious station of multiple persons. And this kind of act of refusal that the protagonist in Moshfegh's novel enacts to a certain degree seems to resonate with me, with this Bartlebyan refusal, due to the fact that it doesn't seem to have a clear reason and also not a clear goal, so to speak. At the same time, there's a marked difference due to the positionality of the narrator, well, who identifies as female and who is more open about her positionality. And at the same time, in the novel, and maybe we'll get to that later, I mean, even this act of refusal is turned into market value, or into artistic market value, when this
yes.
sleeping of hers
yeah.
becomes part of an art project. But yeah.
So there's a close linkage between work and refusal of the status quo for no other reason than we can maybe imagine. And that goes back to my reading response that I talked about in the opening. I was always wondering, what is her problem? So is it okay? So trauma is one response, and you said it's a legitimate, you know, explanation, but it's not enough. We're left with this lack of knowledge about her true motivations, but we keep wanting to construct a psychological reason why she's traumatized, okay, obviously. But no, that's not all of it. She's also, she doesn't give us the answer. She just does what she does, like Bartleby. And she can escape institutionalization, good for her, but she is fired from her job after performing so poorly. So work and opting out of work is one point of view, or one field here, and milieu. The other milieu is art. And you already talked about how her sleep is turned into an art project. She works at the gallery. We need to talk about the art industry in New York City and the monetization of art. So how does sleep become the art project?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there are so many explicit and implicit and very often also ironic references to the contemporary art scene in Western context, or in New York specifically, I suppose. I mean, the gallery's name, I don't know if it was mentioned in the passage that I read, or is called Ducat. So there's the reference to the monetarization of art there as well. So as you said, ultimately she is fired for not performing, but then she kind of makes an arrangement or finds an agreement with one of the most successful artists whom her former boss and her gallery represent, an artist called Ping Xi in the novel, Chinese American artist who's kind of depicted as a shooting star, a transgressive, cutting edge artist, basically. She makes this arrangement with this artist Ping Xi that she will remain locked up in her apartment for 3 months, I believe, and will take this medication that we already mentioned, which puts her to sleep for 3 consecutive days, and that during this time, that for the 3 months that she will basically try to sleep through them, except for these brief moments when she wakes up, has to and that the artist Ping Xi has full access to her apartment and can undergo and kind of create an artwork in that setting, or multiple artworks in that setting, and that there are certain issues that he's asked to take care of, that he kind of leaves her some pizza in the refrigerator and so on and so forth, but ultimately, she is handing her sleeping self over to this art project.
Yeah, and he basically, I think it consists mainly of him coming in and photographing her sleeping, and then putting her body in different positions and things like this. So it's she basically gives her awareness, or her waking self, and shows herself in this super vulnerable state of deep sleep, and he can do whatever he wants with this sleeping body. That's the art project. But there's another instance when she becomes involuntarily an art project, or a commentary on art, when she comes to her art history class, or Feminist Theories and Art Practices 1960s and 1990s at Columbia University. And she walked in late because her heel broke. And the professor points at her and says, "We're just discussing feminist performance art as a political deconstruction of the art world as a commercial industry." And the professor asks her to stand in front of the classroom, which I did, quote, "let my left foot arch like a Barbie's," and the class analyzed it as a performance piece. So she leaves the class after that and takes another class because she feels humiliated by this experience. But the professor, putting her on the spot as a, you know, takes into account her appearance, her waspiness, her good looks, and the fact that she has an artistic, intricate feminist commentary in and of herself, that she is a walking feminist commentary, or maybe post-feminist commentary in this context, because the heels, I think, if I remember correctly, were also Manolo Blahnik heels that she broke. So you can imagine how she appears in front of class, and how this is humiliating for her to be read as a feminist performance art piece, because she wears expensive clothes. What did you think about this scene?
Well, I feel that the text is kind of oscillating there, maybe between various positions or stances, between affirmation and critique with respect to contemporary artistic discourses and practices, for instance, also including commentary and theorizations of art, and their feminist criticism is of course essential and crucial, and I feel that the text seems to indicate that seemingly non-normative or emancipatory critiques are very often also subject to commodification, to becoming a kind of stale or losing their critical and subversive potential, or to becoming kind of cliche due to kind of circulation, performative repetition, and so on and so forth. So this would be in line with a kind of more ironic, maybe even kind of pre or postmodern stance, maybe even to a certain degree rather. At the same time, as you mentioned, there's this affect of humiliation which is being transported, that this the text how it resorts to embodiment, to notions of authenticity as at the same time wagering and kind of presenting being embodied affectivity as a possible counterpoint in relation to this repetition of purely some symbolic acts and discourses which are always already entwined with processes of commodification and the generation of value. But there's also this other passage referring to this project with the artist Ping Shi, where as it is still ongoing, she has this kind of waking sleep, and she imagines what the artworks that he creates while he enters her apartment as she's sleeping, what they might look like. And there's one dream where she imagines them to be mainly nude or semi-nude paintings of a sleeping female figure whose face, however, is not visible. So kind of seeming to be portraits of her, and she interprets this as a kind of critical feminist critique of the long history of the objectification of female gendered bodies throughout art history. That's only her dream. The artwork that Ping Shi in the end then creates has her face kind of or presents her face in an exaggerated or enlarged form. It's consists of paintings and of videos where you also see her speaking into the camera in a kind of sleepy state, or she obviously doesn't seem to be fully conscious. But you do not hear her voice, but it's there's a voiceover by voicemails that Ping Shi's mother left him in Cantonese. So there are so many subtle and not so subtle comments on also the commodification, the tokenization of different positionalities in the art scene which the text depicts. But as maybe as a last point that I could add to that is that but the oscillation remains, and the ambiguity, because there's also another passage, even more towards the end, after the project has already ended, when she enters the Met Museum and she looks at paintings. I mean, they're not the titles aren't mentioned, but one can, due to their description, it seems to be still lives and more realist, possibly 19th century paintings, and she expresses this desire to almost merge with these paintings, and then is being stopped by a guard. And there seems to be nonetheless a certain notion of the sanctity of art, and and so, once more, actually kind of rather archaic, maybe somewhat cliched notions of art that the text also brings into circulation. Which makes it resonate to a certain degree also with this the discourse on meta-modernism, which was circulating for some time. Luke Turner, the artist who wrote the Meta-Modernist Manifesto, kind of claimed that oscillation is kind of the key ingredient of meta-modernism to a certain degree. And also this oscillation between authenticity and ironic detachment, for instance.
Yeah, And so this is, I think this is also a good seed to discussing this a little bit in the context of post 9/11 literature or post-postmodernist literature in the movement of new sincerity and the affective turn, which you already mentioned and which you're working on professionally as a researcher as well. So with David Foster Wallace's manifesto, which already came out in 1993, E Pluribus Unam, which proclaimed there needed to be an end, very short synopsis here, there needed to be an end to post the crisis of representation in postmodernist language play. And in the early 2000s, writers like Ben Lerner, Sheila Heady, Dave Eggers published novels that were autofiction, and this is also true for Tessa Moshfegh's novel, and that circulated around the question of re-engaging with the world and with the reader in a sincere and authentic way. But at the same time, these novels always oscillated, this is the key to what you talked about before, they oscillated between the attempt to do this and at the same time the failure that was already programmed in this. At this point, I'm going to refer to my fabulous colleague from Jena University who just completed his dissertation on the new sincerity movement and the notion of productive failure. And the irony that lies in this. And he basically argues it's a form of romantic irony that they turn to, not so much the postmodernist irony. But that's maybe going too far here. But coming back to the question of new sincerity, a new engagement with the world that is also building on being embodied and feeling feelings, which is also the problem of our protagonist here, and the impossibility to communicate those feelings at the same time. But there's always the attempt, the oscillation, the reaching out. And this often happens in those new sincerity novels through meta-reflective commentary on the production of art. So this is where I think Moshfegh's commentary on art and the art world, its commodification on the one hand, but then the oscillation towards, I want to be a piece of art and my sleep experiment is an artistic practice that I can do with my body. And then I dream about what kind of art it becomes, and then I see the reality of what kind of art it becomes, but I don't judge. I throw it all out there for the reader to either appreciate or respond to or be puzzled about. But it's a kind of bearing all that also involves cringy moments, moments where we observe her body functions that are kind of intimate and embarrassing maybe, but that's key because that's a central component of this new sincerity to showing it all. And the fact that you're showing it all, warts and all, is this act of reaching out and of producing art that invites the reader to be in and that invites the reader to create an authenticity effect, even though we already know it's impossible. So what did you think? New sincerity, affective turns. How does this novel work in this way?
I totally agree with what you mentioned, or think that as you've elaborated on these movements and turns, and they very much reverberate in Moshfegh's novel as well. So, a new sincerity, investment in certain authenticity effects. I mean, I think it's no coincidence, or there's a recording, for instance, of a book release event which took place at the famous Strand bookstore in New York of Moshfegh's novel, where she was in conversation with Lena Dunham, the also author but also a creator of the TV series Girls, to a certain degree also many of those characteristics that you to with respect to new sincerity and authenticity effects, and also the showcasing of modes of embodiment and potentially embarrassing, cringeworthy moments, potentially humiliating embodied experiences that you find that in the novel as well as in a TV series such as Girls. And at the same time, I mean, as you mentioned, those are effects which are achieved through certain representational strategies, and it it just raises new questions, and I mean there are really many resonances also, as I mentioned, between the new sincerity and meta-modernism. I just looked at the manifesto once more, and the meta-modernist manifesto, and there Luke Turner writes that we propose a pragmatic romanticism unhindered by ideological anchorage. So this pragmatism, not necessarily in the philosophical sense, but in the everyday colloquial understanding of the term, and romanticism, once more, this pairing of seemingly oscillating notions, but then unhindered by ideological anchorage. And that's something that I noted with Moshfegh's novel as well, is that it doesn't or rarely references, for instance, in more detail, critical theoretical discourses, which also went along or emerged, took place, circulated in the context in which the novel is set, such as late 1990s art scene. I mean, in the passage that you quoted, there's this reference to feminist criticism, however, in a very superficial way, mm-hmm. and that's also one aspect which maybe distinguishes this text also from a text such as Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, for instance, also regarded as a kind of work of autofiction, but which more copiously and outrightly engages with theoretical debates, referencing, for instance, key positions in queer affect theory or so. And this, in a way, can, of course, then raise the question where the novel stands, if you want to say that. I know that it's at the same time I don't want to reduce it in any way, but this also comes back to the question of the possible Bartleby resonances and so on and so forth. Is if the text in a way remains in this oscillating movement and motion. And one thing that I might add also with respect to new sincerity is that I mean this My Year of Rest and Relaxation is also, of course, a very self-involved text. I mean, this experiment is also fairly solipsistic, mm-hmm. The take on the questions that the new sincerity text maybe raised, such as what comes after the supposed age of irony, or how might there be a reinvestment in embodiedness and authenticity and so on, so forth, be imagined, that I feel that very often, I mean, that maybe also goes hand in hand with the novelistic form, or that the means of mediating those discourses is very often the individual, in a very radical way in Moshfegh's novel, of course. Even at the same time, I mean, this experiment is also an experiment in trying to recede from subjectivity. But I just also, when I prepared myself, had to think of some another kind of post 9/11 text that's maybe not that well known, which is a kind of novelistic experiment called Rena Spallings, by the artistic collective Bernadette Corporation. And that's a collectively written novel where there's also a protagonist, the figure of Rena Spallings, but it's at least an attempt at a non-individualistic take on some of these issues. Yeah.
Yeah. So the individual, the self, the monad, whatever you want to call it, is at the heart of this. And it's super intriguing that you're mentioning this other collective text, which tries to grapple with that obsession with the self or with identity or the individual, which also makes this, you talked about metamodernism as a different term for what comes after postmodernism, and it comes in manifestos. And what I find so intriguing is that, you know, you have this term. I mean, I already talked about David Foster Wallace's manifesto. It's a very avant-gardistic way of engaging with art production, saying, I'm going to write a manifesto and I'm going to say it's got to be without ideological anchors. But that is very an ideological thing to begin with, writing a manifesto and, you know, expecting the art world and people at large to accept the manifesto and say, okay, this is a turn, this is a shift. It marks a coming in of something new. And so you already talked about, we talked about Bartleby. And one of my questions was, how American is this text? But also how modernist or maybe meta-modernist is this text? So when we emailed about this before, I'm also reading Thomas Mann's Zauberberg at this point. And it's one of my favorite books. And I'm going to use this opportunity to recommend it to everyone. And the Zauberberg has a protagonist that he's young, he's healthy, and he only takes a 3-week break in Davos, travels up the mountain to a sanatorium, and then he gets stuck there for 7 years. And he's told over and over that he's sick. And he starts believing it, and he also takes his rest cure. So he lays down after lunch, I think, every day for 3 or 4 hours, and the objective is to do nothing, to really just rest. And he meets all these other European characters, and it's really about a crisis of Europe as before the onset of the 1920s. It's also a moment of crisis, of standstill, of artistic production that has come to an end because there's no more recipes for how to engage with the world. And Hans Castorp, the protagonist, it's not like he experiments willingly, like the unnamed protagonist or narrator of Moschweg's novel, but he is drawn into something that becomes a crazy experience of individualism and subjectivity that goes beyond language in other ways. So I can't talk about the Zauberberg at length here, obviously, even though I would love to, but the modernist moment, as in something comes to an end, new thing has to come in. We need new artistic productions. And this is coupled with a moment of deep economic crisis. So it rings so true in my ears because it's 100 years past. So there's many commentators who say the 1920s or the 2020s are going to be like the 1920s, or I don't know what's happening. We're facing a reset again, that many commentators have compared to the modernist moment, the anxiety and the sense of being overwhelmed with things at the same time. And so I think Moschweg's novel takes up this moment of crisis logic that goes, it even goes beyond the present, and it becomes readable through the 19th century and through maybe also the American exceptionalism narrative that is deconstructed in here. And so I think it's modernist and it's American at the same time. What do you think about the American argument? How American is this text?
I don't know if I
can. I'm sorry. I know it's a biggie, but
I don't know if I can. And how far I can respond to it, but thanks so much for those I just found that I was very intrigued by what you just said, and just had to think somewhat also along those lines, maybe comparing the question of a certain American context and the modernist context at the same time, because I mean drawing on crucial insights from the fields of Black studies, thinking of Black feminist theory, Afro-pessimist theory, for instance, then this modernist moment in particular as a moment, as you said, of crisis and a kind of the idea of referring to power and to make something new and so on and so forth, that this rejuvenation and this artistic expression very much in the American context, but I suppose also in the Western European context, relies upon or is based upon the objection of Blackness and the objectification of Blackness and the treatment of Blackness, also Black cultural expression, as a kind of fungible source for white rejuvenation, for instance, and this is also something which is played out, I would say, in Moshfegh's novel through the protagonist, who is kind of obsessed with Whoopi Goldberg and watches Whoopi Goldberg on VHS videos on repeat, and also sexualizes in certain passages, very much sexualizes Whoopi Goldberg. And in this experiment of receding from life, in this sleep experiment, becoming as inanimate as possible, this character, who once more identifies as white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, seems to need some kind of uttered body, the like female body of Whoopi Goldberg, as some kind of animating, objectifiable utter in a way to in order to persist to a certain degree.
The other episode, of course, that's key is where she goes to get her coffee at the bodega, and the staff there, she only calls them the Egyptians. And they seem to be, they're presented in a super orientalist way. They're described in a, she can't distinguish between individuals, and she doesn't care to. She only gets her coffee there. And in another scene, she takes her friend there, who makes a racist comment, and then she calls out her friend for making a racist comment about the staff at the coffee shop, while she herself has an absolutely essentializing, orientalizing view of the people who work at the coffee store. So she really has no awareness and doesn't seem to care. And also she's unable, obviously, to identify her own privilege. So she's oblivious to the things that have been imparted to her because she's a white person and she's privileged. So we discussed my year of rest and relaxation as a 9/11 novel, as a trauma novel, as a novel of the new sincerity, maybe also a hark back to modernism or metamodernism. And we talked about the aesthetics of sleep in this. So the novel comes at a time where we commemorate and remember, maybe for those of us who lived through the mediatized images of 9/11, where we talk about the meanings of this event in 2001, and we also have to ask about the meanings of U.S. art, feminist art in the present moment in the art industry. And I think it's an appealing read for all those who are interested in contemporary artistic production, contemporary literature, and American culture at large. I would recommend it for reading also in the classroom. And maybe we can close with Marius reminiscing his own teaching experience with the novel in a few, very few words. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about your teaching experience. What do students have to say?
Yeah, thanks. So I've discussed this novel in two seminars, actually, one which dealt with the aesthetics and politics of sleep, and the other one which dealt with presentations of mental health and mental distress and U.S. American literature. And in both of those seminar contexts, the sessions that dealt with Moshfegh's novels were among the most lively, most vibrant discussions in through the entire semester. And the text really appealed to students. At the same time, it also, even though some students also claimed that it was kind of repulsive, it's really good material for discussion, in particular because it touches upon many issues which are highly contemporary, meaning that we've also spoken about and addressed. There seems to be a certain yearning circulating towards authenticity in this still ongoing, in this post 9/11 phase, even if it is still ongoing. At the same time, the question of which role artistic practice can play also with respect to questions of political engagement on a micro-political, personal level with respect to the work environments that we find ourselves in, with respect to questions of race, class, gender, which are also addressed in the novel. And at the same time, I mean, both of those seminar sessions, I taught them online, during the pandemic, and this pandemic situation and the setting or the experiment of the novel, a person kind of isolating themselves from the outside world, hibernating, that resonated a lot, of course, on multiple levels, on cognitive, reflective levels, but also, I suppose, somatically and affectively, and that also made it seem very relevant text to engage with. Yeah.
So it is a text for the present moment in many ways, and it's an appealing text by a young and upcoming American author who's being discussed far and wide. Thank you very much for sharing the teaching experience as well, and thank you for being my guest today. And let's see where the pandemic, the post 9/11 moment, and the present takes us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.